Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. On Friday, May 6th, partners from across the Mid-Atlantic region gathered together for the inaugural Regional Domestic Terrorism Conference in New Brunswick, New Jersey, to discuss how law enforcement and homeland security professionals may counter the current threat of domestic terrorism. This event, hosted by our office, the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, in coordination with the New Jersey Regional Intelligence Academy, provided a forum for various organizations from various states to report on the terrorist threat that exists in the United States and in their jurisdictions. Over the next few weeks, you'll hear from experts in the field, to include Clint Watts, a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, J.M. Berger, a senior fellow from George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, as well as J.J. McNabb, also a fellow from George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. You'll also hear from some of our regional partners, like Liberty Day from the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, more commonly known as START, from the University of Maryland. And finally, Thomas Brzezowski, Counsel for Domestic Terrorism Matters from the U.S. Department of Justice.
Hi, I'm Angie Gett. I'm an intelligence analyst with the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security, and today I'm with J.M. Berger, who is a fellow with George Washington University's Program on Extremism. He is a researcher, analyst, and consultant with a special focus on extremist activities in the U.S. and use of social media. Mr. Berger is the co-author of ISIS, the State of Terror, and author of Jihad Joe, Americans Who Go to War in the Name of Islam. Mr. Berger publishes the website IntelWire.com and has written for Politico, The Atlantic, and Foreign Policy, among others. So to start off, Mr. Berger, could you briefly describe your assessment of the domestic terrorism threat today?
Well, I think that the domestic scene, extremist scene, is really increasingly diverse. We're seeing a lot more activity in a lot of different directions. Anti-government movement has had a real surge in activity over the last couple of years. You know, as we discussed today at the conference, you know, we've seen a huge increase in interest in white nationalism, especially online. There's really very organized activism going on, push that kind of point of view out now. So certainly since the 1990s, I think we're seeing activity at a level that we really haven't seen since then.
So which domestic terrorism group do you perceive to pose the biggest threat to the United States?
It depends on how you're going to define your threat. You know, the sort of anti-government movement that seized the wildlife refuge in Malheur, Oregon, is obviously very activist. They're more organized than most, but still not really that organized. So, you know, they might be able to cause trouble in sort of a limited space, in a limited period of time, that would be a big problem. What's more difficult to quantify is how particularly the increase in white nationalism is really playing out as crime. You know, what we see is that there are certainly a lot of hate crimes. We're seeing rallies and protest actions that are becoming more heated, more violent as people become more polarized. It's harder to quantify that, but that's probably a bigger movement than the sort of anti-government group. And then from the perspective of police, really the sovereign citizens kind of movement and related movements are the most direct threat to police trying to do their jobs. So it's a very diverse threat. It's hard to say any one is more than the other.
So just last month was the 21st anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. So looking back, I wanted to know what your view is on the most important lessons learned from that event.
I think there were many lessons that we didn't learn from that incident. Certainly it woke people up to the concept of domestic extremism in a way that they hadn't appreciated for a while. Since the 70s, wave of domestic terrorism had died down. People tend to forget, you know, there's about a 20-year cycle of forgetting. And so the Oklahoma City bombing reminded them. At the same time, you know, I think the investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing failed to really probe into the networks. I think if it would happen today, somebody yesterday asked me, what would be the difference if the Oklahoma City bombing happened today as opposed to in the 90s? And I think that we're much more conscious of the networks now. You know, we're much more conscious of the fact that it's extraordinarily rare for somebody to really be a lone wolf terrorist. And I think everybody was very happy to write McVeigh off as a lone wolf. But, you know, he came out of both a social context and probably a material support context that helped him to carry out that bombing.
After 9/11, we saw how that intelligence community restructured and there was more focus on international terrorism. Was there the same after the bombing?
It was the reverse, actually. There was a huge focus on these guys up until about 1992, 1993, at which point, because the FBI had actually overreached so much in investigating them, that they got knocked back in order to stand down. I mean, the FBI essentially had a massive infiltration of the domestic right-wing movements. I mean, massive, like, you know, informants, undercover operations. And, you know, they escalated to the level that some people near the top of the agency and some judges looked at this and said, this is like, you're not like investigating a crime. You're doing domestic intelligence gathering of a type that is not constitutional. And then, you know, obviously, attitude toward jihadists was so different too. It was like, you know, they knew that like these guys were coming back and forth from Afghanistan. They just didn't care. They like didn't count them. Mm-hmm. Nobody even has a reasonable count.
Yeah. So then looking at Ruby Ridge and Waco, Texas, the standoffs, what lessons do you think were learned from law enforcement's encounter with those two standoffs? And did you see those being applied in the Oregon standoff this year?
I think they're definitely, maybe we saw the lessons of Waco and Ruby Ridge being applied to a fault at the Malheurs standoff. I think in the case of Ruby Ridge, there were clear problems in how the FBI handled that situation. In the case of Waco, there was a huge loss of life, although arguably less culpability for the FBI in that encounter. But in both cases, they really inflamed domestic extremist movements. One thing we know about how domestic extremist movements differ from international movements is that the domestic actors usually need a specific grievance. They need to feel like they didn't fire the first shot. So an event like Ruby Ridge or Waco gives them that cause to
impetus.
Yes. So, you know, what we saw in Malheur is that the standoffishness was almost at comical levels because these guys just were out there for weeks before the FBI even had any kind of visible presence. And, you know, and I think a lot of people were justifiably unhappy about that. And then in the end, when they finally did wrap it up, they ended up shooting one of these guys anyway and kind of creating the potential for that cause belli that, you know, can provoke follow-on violence. So I think the lesson learned from Malheur is that we maybe overlearned the lessons from Ruby Ridge and Waco.
That's a good one. So on that note, since Waco, the federal government seems to have taken, like you said, a more patient approach when it comes to standoff situations with anti-government extremists. Do you see any risks in continuing that same approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is wisdom in holding off. And part of the wisdom in holding off in a situation like this is based on your expectation of the group. The problem is that it does start to create a double standard, which then fuels other grievances and other kinds of social unrest and extremist unrest. So, I mean, you know, one of the most common things you saw in the description of this was, you know, what if these guys had all been black? Would the FBI have held off as long as they did? Would the state authorities have held off as long as they did? And the answer is probably not. So, you know, you need to be sensitive to that double standard. But at the same time, if you can de-escalate a situation, and any time you can de-escalate a situation so that nobody gets hurt, is a good thing.
So what do you think is the state of the anti-government movement in the wake of the Oregon standoff? Is it more or less unified? You spoke about how they killed Robert Lavoie Finicum and that how that could fuel more things in the future.
I think that it is more fractured right now in the wake of these events because there was a big division in anti-government circles around the decision to take control of the refuge. And, you know, when it went badly, I think there was a lot of backbiting and second guessing and backseat driving. And so everybody's kind of mad at everybody else. And the people who are doing the criticizing are the people who didn't show up. And the people who showed up are mad at the people who are staying at home and criticizing. And so there is a core group of people who are probably the bigger violence risk who are really incensed by what happened. And some of those may be pulling together into smaller groups. But, you know, in terms of the effect on the wider movement, I think this was very demoralizing for them.
Yeah. So shifting topics a little to ISIS and white supremacist groups, when we look at both of those groups, to me, they appear to be a little more cult-oriented. So what I mean by that is the two groups tend to isolate themselves and are very exclusive. They hold a very bipolar view of the world, so it's kind of like an us versus them mentality. So in terms of new recruits, they become isolated from external social connections, and new relationships are forged within these movements. That being said, what other similarities can you identify between ISIS and white supremacists?
Well, they're both identity politics, really. You know, it's ultimately about your identity group and being superior and dominant over all other identity groups. And fundamentally, a lot of people, when they talk about ISIS, they want to talk about, you know, is ISIS Islamic? Is, you know, is this a problem with Muslims that's causing the rise of a group like this? And for me, when I look at ISIS, I see a group that is more similar to other extremist groups, no matter what the stripe, whether it's white nationalist or, you know, a Christian religious cult or Mormon cult. So to me, ISIS is a very characteristic extremist group and not a very characteristic Muslim group. And so it's the same thing with white nationalism. When you look at how a group like the cult or the National Socialist Movement or, you know, Hammerskins operates, they operate really on that kind of very tight organizational basis, you know, and it's not really like the average white person.
Lastly, just to wrap up, what books are you currently reading that you can recommend to our listeners?
Well, one that I read recently was Lavoy Finicum's book, Only by Blood and Suffering, which is a dystopian novel of grazing rights gone bad, basically. I think it's kind of interesting because with his death, the book is selling remarkably well, really very well. Now, the question is whether it has content that is something to be concerned about when you compare it to a book like The Turner Diaries. The Turner Diaries, I think, is much more incitement to violence than Finicum's book. Finicum's book is kind of quirky and characteristic of, you know, sort of this anti-Bureau of Land Management movement. A lot of it is about land management, but, you know, it also features an EMP going off and a lot of different survivalist kind of how-to tips. So I don't know, you know, when I read the book and I came away from it, I wasn't sure exactly what the message it was trying to convey was. It didn't have a very clear call to action, but, you know, it's certainly putting a lot of eyes on the content that's written from, you know, this domestic extremist perspective. So I think that that's something to sort of keep an eye on. But it's about an EMP goes off in the United States and then a family has to come together on a ranch and fight off petty Bureau of Land Management barbarians who come to oppress them in the, as society breaks down. I mean, it's kind of unintentionally funny if you're not in the movement, you know, because there's scenes like there's a, like stops in a state park to camp and then there's like a fascist camp ranger who's like oppressing people and doesn't really line up with, you know, necessarily what your experience of the park system might be.
Well, Mr. Berger, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.